¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Lowe's has the brands pros trust to get the job done. You can now shop new Catalyst fencing solutions and save big when you do. 10% off when you buy in bulk. Plus, save $180 on a DeWalt 12-inch dual bevel sliding compound miter saw. Now just $449. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/6 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
I'm so glad you're here. This is Avery After Dark, and I'm your host, Avery Ross. These 3 true hauntings sound almost too unbelievable to be real, but they are. And the last one is a case that police still can't explain. Thank you so much for tuning in for this episode. If you enjoy Avery After Dark, leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Let's get right into it. Our first haunting. It became known as Wisconsin's own Amityville Horror, a bizarre haunting that shocked the town and captured the attention of the world. It involves the very normal, church-going Tallman family in a secondhand bunk bed the family purchased for their children. A bunk bed! You heard me right. Let's start from the beginning. This case took place in Horicon, Wisconsin, which is a small Midwestern farming town, a safe and quiet place to raise a family. It was a life the Tallman family was drawn to when they moved into their house there in 1986. Alan and Debbie Tallman and their kids found a new place to call home. The home was a 1-floor, smaller ranch-style house, a place she would never think would be the setting for what came next. And when purchasing the place, the Tallmans figured this was a spot they would be in for years to come. So they decided to start buying pieces of furniture for the family home and fixing up the house as they saw fit. You know, making the place their own. That next year, as the kids were growing, Alan and Debbie decided to head out to a secondhand furniture shop. There, they came upon a used bunk bed that they thought would be great for the new house. They were in awe, as it looked almost brand new, and they thought, hey, this would be perfect for their younger kids. They purchased it, brought it home, and assembled it in the basement, where the family stored it for a few months until one day, they moved the bunk beds upstairs. This was a decision that the family would come to regret. Big time. This decision led to 9 months of terror for the Tallmans. Almost instantly, strange things began happening in the home. The very first night the bunk beds were moved upstairs, one of the Tallmans' children, named Danny, went to sleep in his room next door to the room the family put the bunk beds in. After falling asleep, an old clock radio in Danny's room came alive. It turned on and started switching stations on its own. Danny jumped up, scared, and ran into his parents' bedroom. He frantically told his parents that the radio had turned on all by itself. And not just that. He said that he saw the dial was moving on its own, as if someone or something invisible was in the room with him, moving it. The parents didn't really believe this and just ended up taking the radio out of the room and chalked this up to Danny having a wild imagination. But then, something else. Within weeks, all the Tallmans' children, who rarely fell ill, began getting really sick. Debbie said there were some weeks when all of the kids would all be at the doctor's office at the same time. She had no idea what was going on, but this was unlike anything they had experienced. She said the kids never really got sick before this. A few weeks later, Alan himself had an experience. He was in the basement near where the family had stored the bunk beds prior to moving them upstairs. And down there, he was painting the walls, trying to fix it up a bit. when he decided to take a break, go upstairs and get something to eat. As he left, he placed his paintbrush on the table. When he came back down to the basement about 30 minutes later, he saw the brush had been moved. He found it had been dropped handle first into the bucket of paint. There was no one else in the basement with Alan, so he didn't really know what to think about this. A few nights later, the tall man's daughter began sleeping in the bunk beds, and almost instantly began telling her parents that she was scared to sleep there because she was seeing things in the room. She told her mom, Debbie, that she saw an old witch-looking woman that would stand behind the door and watch her at night. She said the woman had long black hair and glowed like fire. A few weeks later, one of the tall man's other children, who didn't know anything about what his little sister had seen, told his parents that he woke up in the middle of the night to see an old woman, a witch-looking lady, standing by his door, and said she glowed like fire. All over the house, strange things were happening. Doors banged open and shut on their own, a chair rocked by itself, disembodied voices called out to the family from empty rooms. At this point, the family was starting to believe that their house was haunted. So they decided to bring in their pastor, Reverend Wayne Dobratz. After a walkthrough, he said he felt the presence of evil in the home, the devil. He believed the activity was demonic. The Reverend blessed the home, and the family hoped that this would help. But the activity continued, and it really seemed to center around the children. They were seeing apparitions, hearing voices calling out to them, and seeing that old witch. They soon became so scared that they no longer wanted to stay in the house at all. So there was really no peace within the home. Frustrated, one day, Alan began pacing around the house, shouting at the top of his lungs. He had hit his limit. He screamed, "Pick on me, leave my kids alone, show yourself. If you want to fight someone, fight me." Hoo boy. Whatever entity was inhabiting the house and terrorizing the family seemed to accept the challenge. Just a few weeks later, Alan arrived back home around 2 a.m. after working the late shift. As he made his way inside, he heard a strange howling sound coming from the garage. He went to go investigate and said it was then he heard a voice coming from behind the house saying, "Come here." Alan walked around, couldn't see anything, so as he turned to walk back towards the front of the house, he heard that same voice saying again, "Come here, come here." He then looked up to see red flames shooting inside the garage. He said the flames had a glow with red eyes. After this, Alan was in distress and began sleeping on the floor of his daughter's room. The kids were terrified at that point and felt better with their dad in the room. One night, as Alan was on the ground about to fall asleep, he said a fog rose up from the floor, formed the shape of flames with green eyes peering at him. A voice then emerged saying, "You're dead." And then it was gone. This really shook Alan, and from then on, just like his kids, he was terrified of whatever entity was in the home. A few days later, a relative of the family spent the evening at the house, helping Debbie with the children while Alan worked late. Now, this relative was a skeptic of the paranormal. He really didn't believe in it. So when they said the house was haunted, he didn't care. He thought, I'll be fine. But he wasn't. But on this evening, this relative became a believer when that night, he saw a horrific figure materialize in the bedroom as he was putting the kids to sleep. And that was it. After 9 long months of torment, the Tallman family fled their home that night in the dead of a Wisconsin winter. They had finally had enough. 2 weeks after the Tallmans left their home, they had the bunk bed destroyed. But news spread all over town, and everyone was talking about the haunting. Media quickly descended on the otherwise sleepy and quiet neighborhood, along with hordes of curious thrill seekers and paranormal enthusiasts. Rumors of ghosts had swept through the crowd at a Friday night basketball game at the local high school, and hundreds of cars began pouring down Larrabee Street past the Tallman home. People were walking through the yards of all the other homes on the block, climbing over fences, peering into windows of the home, many saying, well, they're not afraid of ghosts. So they tried to open the doors and windows of the Tallman home, and were intent on getting inside to prove how unafraid they really were. When the police got there and ordered the looky-loos to get away from the house, a few wannabe Ghostbusters put up a fight, and arrests for disorderly conduct were made. And in the end, the street was barricaded for a while. It got out of control. Partially because this was a small town, so hey, this was kind of exciting news and it spread fast. But also because of how strange the whole story was. What do you mean this family has a haunted bunk bed? Come on. The Tallman's haunting became a spectacle, and the house became known as Wisconsin's very own Amityville, a place of pure evil. Reverend Dobratz returned to the home after the Tallmans moved out in hopes of inciting whatever evil had taken up residence there. And the town's police chief, Doug Glayman, didn't think the house was haunted, but after speaking with the family, he was convinced that they truly experienced the things that they claimed and saw that the Tallmans didn't want notoriety, they didn't want their faces in the public eye. They were just scared. This police chief was a skeptic, though, so he and two other officers scoured the house looking for evidence of a prank. Hidden recorders or projectors. But they found nothing, and also couldn't find any way the family was or wanted to benefit from such an ordeal. In the end, the Tallmans went on to move to another city and said they didn't experience anything paranormal ever again. So, this haunting is beyond insane. Am I right? What's really strange about this story is that everything changed for the family when they brought in this bunk bed. They didn't report any activity within the home before that, which gets into the realm of haunted items. When you purchase something at a secondhand store, it's true, you have no idea who owned it before you, or what happened near or on the item. But when I hear this story, I really wonder if it was just a bunk bed, or if there was something already in the house when they moved in, but the activity became amplified. The Tallmans were doing work to the home, changing things around, painting, moving furniture. It just makes me wonder. But what do you think? Do you believe this entity was attached to the bunk bed, as the family believes, or to the house itself? Or some sort of a supernatural combination? Let me know in the comments. I would love to hear your take on this case. Haunted bunk beds? Just when you thought you had seen and heard it all on this show, right? Our next haunting gets even stranger. For centuries, many have believed that spirits can communicate with us through dreams. And if you have a repeating dream, it could be because you're not catching an important message the first or second time around. And this is exactly what happened to a woman named June Ferris. And these dreams led her down the rabbit hole into a strange, unsolved murder mystery that has haunted a community for years. In August 1968, it all began. June, who lived with her family in Richmond, Virginia, began having a reoccurring dream about a house. The house was a big mansion, but it was odd because this home was unfamiliar to June. It wasn't one she had seen, recognized, or even stepped foot in. Every dream was the exact same. June said she was in an upstairs bedroom of this mansion. She would walk out into the hallway, then she would turn right, go down the back narrow staircase, go into the kitchen area, walk out through the kitchen door, and then outside onto the porch. And then, every time, she would wake up. In these dreams, June said she would always feel anxious, nervous, like something was about to happen that she should know about. And they would always end at that exact same point, as soon as she stepped foot onto that back porch. She didn't know where she was in the dream or what she was supposed to be doing there. June had this dream so often, she knew the exact layout of this house, where every room was. And she said she had this reoccurring dream at least once a month for 4 years. In 1972, June and her family packed up and made a move to Orlando, Florida. Now, this is where things get really freaky. June had lived in Orlando for about 2 years, when one day she was traveling through the small town of Claremont, Florida. She came upon a big Victorian mansion with a for sale sign in the front yard. This house instantly called to June. It was magnetic. There was something about it that felt so much like home to her, even though she had never seen it before. The mansion was striking. It sat in a quiet neighborhood just a few blocks from the downtown area. June had always loved that style of home, and she and her family were looking for a place to live. So she copied down the information on the sign and called up the realtor to set up a time for her to walk through. The day came for the tour, and June excitedly entered the home. And instantly, she got a really eerie feeling, like she had been there before. She walked around the first floor, then up the staircase, and began walking down the second floor hallway. June said it was like deja vu. She realized this was the house from her dreams. She said she already knew where every room was, every closet. She was familiar with the entire layout of the home. She would point and say, "Oh, that's a closet." And the realtor's like, "Wait, how did you know that?" Because this was long before the days you could browse a home online. June walked through the old mansion, knowing she had already been there dozens and dozens of times. And she said it didn't scare her. She wasn't weirded out by it. She felt like this was where she was supposed to be, like she had finally come home. After the tour, she knew she had to have the house. In March 1978, June, her husband, and their three children moved into the old Victorian from her dreams. And almost instantly, things got really spooky. As June's family was unpacking their belongings one of those first days, June's husband had his boat out on a trailer hitch. He had it propped up on a sawhorse stand and was going to leave it parked in the driveway. He had it evenly set out on the stand, then turned, walked back towards the house, when suddenly, it was like someone picked the trailer hitch up and dropped it to the ground. This huge boat moved on its own. He went back over, asking the kids if they had moved it, and they said no. This happened again a couple more times. The kids and June's husband watched in shock, asking themselves, what's going on here? Over the years, strange things continued in the home, and the family began to think that this house was haunted. They didn't find it scary either, rather fascinating. One night, June's daughter Robin, who was around 21 years old, who had been living at the house with her husband David, both fell asleep for the night. When in the early morning hours, David woke Robin up, asking her if she heard that sound. Robin woke up and heard a melody coming from the next room. The family had a shelf full of music boxes. She walked in there to find all of them were playing. Even scarier, she looked down to find that none of their switches were on. They were somehow playing while being turned off. This incident reassured Robin that their house was haunted. In 1985, June's daughter Lori began dating a man named Bob Vitter. When Bob first came to the house, he met the family, and the topic of ghosts came up. Lori, along with the rest of the family, told him that they believed their house was haunted. Bob said he wasn't a big believer in ghosts and shrugged it off. That same year, it was a few nights before Halloween, Bob and Lori were at the house, sitting on the couch watching TV, when suddenly, they heard the screen door to the back porch open and then slam shut. Lori said, must be my mom. But then they heard the sound of men's boots walking through the kitchen down the hallway. Bob said, that doesn't sound like your mom. The footsteps grew closer and closer into the very room the two were sitting in. Bob jumped up with the feeling that whatever it was now in the room with them. The sound of the footsteps continued down the hallway. Bob followed. He then watched as a door at the end of the hallway opened and shut on its own, and the sound of the footsteps faded into the distance. Bob was stunned. It was truly as if someone had walked through the back porch door straight past them. Not long after this, one afternoon, Robin was walking up the front stairway to head upstairs when she suddenly felt a frigid cold chill. She looked up to see the ghost of a man walk past her down the steps. She said he looked to be in his mid-30s, and within a few seconds, he disappeared. This was the first sighting of the home's entity. Up until that point, they had heard him, but not seen him. June's grandson, who lived at the house, would wake up to see the ghost of a man at the foot of his bed watching him sleep. This happened on numerous occasions. He was terrified by this and would scream and yell for his mom when he would see him. Robin eventually walked into the room one day and told the spirit, enough. Leave her son alone. And after that, he never saw the ghost again. A few months after this, Bob was at the house upstairs getting ready to do some painting for the family. He opened up the attic door, began walking up the steps, when he too looked up and saw the entity, the same ghostly man. Then Bob said he felt a cold blast, smelled a musty smell, and this entity quickly passed through him down the steps. Bob, after hearing and now seeing the entity, was now a big believer in ghosts. Determined to find out more information, Bob went to the archives and began looking into the history of the old Victorian. And what he found horrified him. He found a cluster of newspaper articles and quickly learned that the house the family was currently living in was the scene of a shocking murder just a few years before. The murder victim's name was John Harden, a prior owner of the home. 32-year-old John was shot in the home's driveway and died. Instantly, Bob connected John's age to the male presence the family had seen and heard in the home. He believed this could very well be the ghost that was haunting the old Victorian mansion. But who was John Harden? John grew up in Florida, and at 18, he married his high school sweetheart, a woman named Rita. The couple had four children and lived in Jacksonville, Florida. But after 14 years of marriage, John told his wife that he was going to be leaving for a while, but told her that he would be back. But Rita said John never came back. He left the family. A year or two later, John remarried and with his second wife, moved to Claremont and bought the old Victorian. The family had only lived there just under a year. When on March 22nd, 1975, John woke up in the middle of the night to the smell of smoke. He looked out of his second-story bedroom window to see that his truck was on fire. He ran out of his bedroom, down the second floor hallway, down the back staircase, through the kitchen, and out the back porch door towards the driveway. If you're hearing this and saying, wait a second, this is the exact route that June would take in her dreams. John ran out to find his truck was engulfed in flames. He frantically tried to put it out, but John had no idea that someone was waiting in the bushes. This individual then shot John once in the chest with a shotgun from close range. And within the hour, John was dead. The suspected murder weapon was discovered by police in the bushes, and they also found the phone lines to the house had been cut before the murder. Police determined that the killer had deliberately set fire to John's truck to get him out of the house, where he or she was lying in wait. That is chilling. And no one was ever arrested or charged in John's murder. Investigators spoke to everyone connected to John, friends of his, family, neighbors, but they could never find a motive behind this. Notably, the old Victorian mansion is located close to the boat ramps and riverfront district of Claremont. Some theorize that the killer simply strolled away from the home that night and onto a waiting boat, where they fled in the darkness. Murders are very infrequent in Claremont. When a homicide does take place, the success rate of solving it is almost 100%. But John's case remains a mystery. One special agent working the case said that it was one of the most difficult ones he had ever worked on. When June learned of what happened to John that night, in his route, his final run down the stairs out the back door, she recognized it from her dreams. It was the same path that she took. She said she felt like there was a link between the dreams and the crime, like maybe there was something she was supposed to see in those reoccurring dreams, to notice and possibly help solve the crime. But she never made it past that porch. She always woke up as soon as she made it outside. June believed that John was using the dreams to try and show what happened to him in those final moments of his life, and maybe help find his killer. Robin, June's daughter, felt the same way, as if John's ghost was always reminding the family that he was still there. His case was still unsolved. He had unfinished business. Years later, in 1990, June and her family moved out of the old Victorian mansion. And not surprisingly, the family that moved in after, Ken and Donna Hartley, also believed that the house was haunted. Specifically, a male spirit that roamed the halls. Some of the family's guests said they had seen unusual entities and heard strange footsteps and other noises in the house. John's unsolved murder case was reopened by Lake County Sheriff's Office, and they stated they had several suspects, but not enough evidence to charge anyone in John's murder. So his case remains unsolved to this day, and his murderer, presumably a free man or woman, and it remains Claremont's only unsolved homicide. The Hartleys said the paranormal activity in the home went dormant and seemed to stop around 1992. This story is so fascinating and so spooky because June was dreaming about this house years before she ever stepped foot in it. If you remember, she was in a different state, thousands of miles away, when the dreams began. If that doesn't blow your mind, I don't know what will. Not only was this a premonition of her living in the home, she was apparently already connecting to the spirit inside the house. And for longtime listeners, you know, this is far from the first case we've covered where someone will move into a home and a murder victim that lived there before will send the new resident dreams in an attempt to help solve their case. But I gotta know, what are your thoughts on this story? I always love getting your take. Have you ever experienced anything similar to this? Dreaming of a place you've never been or a person you've never met and wondering the significance of it all? The protocol for solving a murder mystery is usually fairly straightforward. Police and forensics arrive at the crime scene. They ID the victim, start hunting for clues, and chase down any and all leads that may point them towards the killer. Investigators interview possible witnesses, family members, and friends of the victims in hopes of getting a better idea of the suspect's motive. And hopefully, all of this leads straight back to the killer. Now, this is a process we've seen over and over again in movies and TV. But we know life is not scripted, and many murder cases do not get solved in real life. So what happens when leads dry up and the case goes cold? What then? This is exactly what happened in the murder case of Teresita Bassa. Teresita's murder was a mystery investigators were hoping to solve. And they would get a tip from someone who led them straight to her killer. This tip came from the last person anyone expected to hear from, Teresita Bassa herself. Her ghost helped solve her own murder. Oh, and she also provided tangible evidence so police could prosecute her killer. Teresita Bassa's story was covered on Unsolved Mysteries years back, and a co-creator of the show ranked this story as one of the show's top creepiest cases ever. That really says a lot, doesn't it? This story starts on a cold winter's night in Chicago. On February 21st, 1977, the fire department had received a call from the Pine Grove Avenue apartments. Residents of the lakefront residential building reported smelling smoke somewhere in the building. Firefighters got to the scene and they found the fire was coming from an upper floor apartment. They run inside, locate the apartment, open the door, and see the living room is engulfed in flames. And the source of the fire seemed to be a mattress in the living room that had been torched. Thankfully, firefighters were able to put the fire out quickly. Unfortunately, they soon realized that the fire was not accidental. It was used to hide a crime. They initially thought the apartment was empty as they didn't hear or see anyone. But then they discovered something truly horrific. They lifted up that mattress and found the body of 48-year-old Teresita Bassa. This had now gone from a fire to homicide, and police were immediately called to the scene. They found that Teresita Bassa had been stabbed in the chest with a butcher knife. The more they investigated, it looked like the killer had set a fire to cover up the murder, destroy evidence. From the jump, the case perplexed investigators, as everyone who knew her had nothing but lovely things to say about Teresita Bassa. This was a woman who had no enemies and lived a quiet life. She was not in the midst of any big disputes, divorces, breakups, so police dug a bit deeper. They found that Teresita Bassa had moved from the Philippines to the United States in the 1960s to pursue music. She loved music and felt that America would be the best place to chase her dreams. However, after getting to the United States, her passion for music was overshadowed by a newfound love, helping people. Teresita started a career as a respiratory therapist and worked at Edgewater Hospital in Chicago. So Teresita was a lifesaver. Her job was quite literally helping people breathe, helping people live. Amazing. Co-workers who knew her spoke of Teresita and said she was a dedicated professional who gave all she had to her work. There wasn't anything Teresita wouldn't do to help a patient, no matter how long it took. Family, colleagues, friends, all described her as a smart and unassuming woman. So who would murder Teresita? And why? Chicago detective Joe Stahula was assigned to the case and said there seemed to be no apparent motive here. Very little evidence. From the fire and smoke, all fingerprints were destroyed. So that was a dead end. There also didn't appear to be anything stolen or missing from Teresita's apartment. But they did find one thing. A note. The only clue investigators had was inside Teresita's apartment, they found a note. This note read, "Get theater tickets for AS." Who was AS? It appeared Teresita had written the note herself, and this led detectives to believe that she could have been expecting someone with the initials AS at her apartment the night she was murdered, but also thought it could stand for something else entirely, like a business. They didn't know who or what AS was, but the initials were branded in their memory. Investigators interviewed friends and family, and according to her friend, Ruth Loeb, everything was per usual leading up to the day she was murdered. She said Teresita went to work as she always did the day of. She reportedly left the hospital around 5:30 p.m. and spoke to Ruth for about 30 minutes. Before ending the conversation, she said she was expecting a male visitor whose identity she never mentioned, and she never gave any clue as to why this person would be visiting either. But that was it. A note with a mysterious AS initial and the fact that Teresita said she was expecting a male visitor the night she was killed. This case left investigators stumped. So with very little to go on, the case went cold. Nearly 6 months passed with no movement in the case, when one day, police received a very mysterious call that began to unravel the entire thing. Detectives were shocked by the tip, as it was just as mysterious as the murder itself. This call would take this case into the world of the paranormal, the unexplained. The call came from a Chicago doctor named Jose Chua. He prefaced it by saying, he knows this is going to sound insane, but he claimed that his wife Remy was having visions about Teresita's murder. If that isn't chilling enough, he added that Remy was going into trance-like states where Teresita Bassa was possessing his wife and speaking to him from beyond the grave. Through her. A full-on possession. And according to him, her ghost was naming her killer. At this point, Detective Joe Stahula was desperate and was following up on every lead he could in hopes of solving this case. And being a seasoned detective, he had seen and heard his fair share of strange things. So he decided to pay a visit to this couple in hopes he could learn more. Detective Stahula sits down with the couple at their home one day and asked them to give him more information. And he found that the couple had a connection to Teresita Bassa. Dr. Jose Chua had heard about Teresita's murder from his wife Remy, who worked with Teresita. She was also a respiratory therapist at the same hospital and knew Teresita. Remy also was from the Philippines, so the two women had a lot in common. Jose and Remy went on to tell Detective Stahula about what they had experienced, and it was otherworldly. They said late one night a few months back, Remy had worked a long shift at the hospital. So she decided to go to the hospital lounge, lie down, and take a short nap. She said the second she closed her eyes, she immediately sensed that she wasn't alone anymore in the room. She felt a presence. She then opened up her eyes to see the ghost of Teresita Bassa. Remy said she couldn't believe her eyes and froze. She said she began to pray and did not know what to make of seeing Teresita's spirit. A couple weeks later, the couple had another experience. This particular evening, Remy had gone to sleep early. She said she was feeling extremely fatigued, just not feeling quite right. So she went into the bedroom and lied down. A short time later, Jose went in their bedroom to check on her, see if she was doing okay. And it was then he leaned in and asked Remy how she was doing. And she began to speak, except it wasn't her voice coming out. As Remy's eyes were closed, Jose heard a different, soft female voice saying, "Help me." He was completely stunned and was trying to get his wife to talk more and more, and he asked her, "Who are you? What is your name?" The voice coming from Remy emerged again saying, "I'm Teresita Bassa. You must go to the police. They can't find my killer. You have to tell them his name is Alan Showery. He's an orderly who works at the hospital. Tell them." Now, this was actually before Jose knew anything about Teresita or what had happened to her. He said this entire exchange lasted a few minutes until eventually his wife woke up. He told her all about what had happened, that she became possessed, and that's when he was informed about Teresita's recent murder. At this point, the couple didn't know what to make of this, but said they didn't say anything or go to anyone as they feared looking ridiculous and honestly didn't think anyone would believe them. But then, a few nights later, it happened again. Teresita was back. The second time, as his wife lay next to him asleep, Teresita's spirit possessed Remy again. And this time, Teresita's spirit was much more insistent. Jose recalled and said the voice emerged again and asked, "Why did you not go to the police? Why?" He answered her and said that he didn't because they would need more than this. They would need proof, evidence. The voice, Teresita's spirit, then replied back and said, "I have proof. I have evidence, and I will give it to you." Teresita continued and said, "After he killed me, he stole my jewelry, and he gave it to his girlfriend." After this time, Jose and his wife felt that they needed to go to police with this information. Detective Stahula listened to this couple. He had worked as a police officer and detective for years, and he said he knew when someone truly believed what they were telling him. He had a sense, as many great detectives do, when someone is telling the truth or when someone is lying. He said he knew this couple completely believed what they were telling him. But what this couple was saying was out of this world. It seemed unbelievable. And he was struck by something when he hears their story. He immediately hears the name Alan Showery and recalls the note in Teresita's apartment with the initials AS. Maybe this isn't so unbelievable. So from here, Detective Stahula really feels like he might be onto something. His next stop is Edgewater Hospital. There, he gets a background check to see if there is an Alan Showery who works at the hospital. And it turns out, he does. He works there as an orderly. Detective Stahula finds out that not only did Alan know and work with Teresita, he only lived a few blocks away from her. Detective Stahula then sat down and interviewed a few other co-workers of Teresita's at the hospital. And they tell him that actually, Alan was supposed to go over to Teresita's to help her fix a TV the night she was murdered. Just a few days before this, police had nothing. Now, Detective Stahula believes he has a really strong lead. He could crack this case wide open. He brings Alan Showery in for questioning, and Alan admitted he had gone to Teresita's apartment that night to repair the TV. So he claimed he left and went back home to his apartment he shared with his girlfriend, and that was that. But Detective Stahula, with his investigator instinct, knew there was more. He kept pressing Alan, but wasn't getting anywhere. So he went to Alan's girlfriend, a woman named Yanka Kamluck, and asked her if Alan had gifted her any jewelry in the past few months. And she tells Detective Stahula, why yes, he has. She brought in the jewelry for investigators to look over, and Teresita's family members were also brought in. They look over all the pieces, and instantly, Teresita's family recognized a jade necklace that belonged to Teresita, along with several other pieces of jewelry. One of these was a ring that Alan's girlfriend was actually wearing. Teresita's family pointed to it and said that Teresita was wearing that exact ring the last time they ever saw her alive. Detective Stahula went back to Alan Showery and told him that Teresita Bass's family ID'd the jewelry that he had given to his girlfriend as belonging to Teresita Bassa. Confronted with this, Alan Showery made a full confession. He said he had gone to Teresita's apartment that night to help fix a TV, but as he was returning home, on the way back, he came up with a plan to murder and rob Teresita. Alan admitted he came back, knocked on her door. When she opened it and let him back in, he attacked her and put her into a chokehold until she stopped struggling. He then went into the next room, pulled a mattress into where Teresita was, and set fire to it. But he discovered that Teresita didn't keep much cash in the apartment, so Alan took her jewelry and left her there. Alan Showery, despite confessing to her murder, pled not guilty. And when a mistrial was declared because of a hung jury, it looked like he was about to get away with murder. Alan then reversed and admitted his guilt. Now, the obvious explanation for this reversal was a sentence reduction, but many people think that Teresita's ghost paid him a visit in prison. He was sentenced to 14 years in prison and served only 5 years and was later released in 1983. And it's been reported that no one has really seen or heard from Alan Showery since. The story of Teresita Bassa hit newspapers across the U.S. as the case where a ghost solved her own murder. And to this day, Remy maintains that she was possessed by Teresita's spirit. And detectives really have no other explanation for what happened or how it happened. One of the biggest takeaways from all of this is, without Teresita's spirit coming forward with that tip about the stolen jewelry, police would have never have known it was missing. They had no idea it was ever even stolen. And thus, police would have had no way to prove that Alan had stolen it, tying him directly to the murder scene. When reflecting on the case, Detective Stahula called the entire thing bizarre and said he doesn't know what to think. But following the arrest of Alan Showery, Detective Stahula became the butt of the joke around the police department. His colleagues, other police officers and detectives, would reportedly leave him phone messages pretending to be ghosts, spirits. Now here's where things get even more chilling. After the arrest, it was reported that three other Edgewater Hospital employees also saw the ghost of Teresita Bassa after her murder. But none of them wanted to come forward or were afraid to, out of fear of being made fun of or called crazy. And it gets even creepier. After this case, a book was written about the entire ordeal in 1979. Everyone was talking about it. People wanted to know more. This was unlike anything anyone had ever heard of. So the Chuas began working on a book with writers, editors, and working with a publishing team. And all of those who were involved in writing this book started experiencing some really strange things. They began receiving mysterious phone calls at their offices. Office supplies, papers would be moved, hidden, or on some occasions, fly off the shelves on their own. And they too believed that this had to be paranormal. This entire story is so interesting because of how many people experienced paranormal events connected to the case, connected to Teresita's murder. You have Jose and Remy, the three other Edgewater Hospital employees, as well as all those who are working on the book about the murder case, all having supernatural experiences. Wow. I find it so fascinating that after Jose didn't go to police after that first encounter, Teresita came back and was like, "What's the deal? What's taking so long?" It seemed that Teresita Bassa was going to get her murder case solved, no matter how long it took. It's just astonishing. We as humans have limitations. Those in the spirit realm do not. And it gets even deeper. Edgewater Hospital went on to actually close in 2001 after 72 years of serving Chicago. Why? Because of a massive Medicare fraud scandal involving some of the medical center's executives and doctors was exposed, and the hospital went down quickly. A lot of really shady stuff went down there, and after that, Edgewater sat abandoned for years. It was truly frozen in time. The place was haunting. So in the end, this hospital that connected so many of the players in this case decayed into this nightmarish memory of decades past. In recent years, Edgewater was purchased and turned into luxury apartments. All in all, this case leaves me absolutely bewildered and amazed. But what do you think? Do you believe that Teresita Bassa's spirit really helped solve her own murder? It sure seems that way, doesn't it? Thank you so much for tuning in for this episode. If you enjoy Avery After Dark, leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Let me know what has been your favorite episode so far. I want to make sure I keep bringing you stories that you love to hear. If you want all these episodes ad-free, join the Patreon. You also get bonus episodes of Avery After Dark. Next episode, I've got so much more creepiness coming your way. Until then, this is Avery After Dark.